Radio Gorgeous, created by women for women. RadioGorgeous.com. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Rebecca McKenzie.
Hello, it's great to be here.
Could you introduce your book?
Yes, In a Land of Paper Gods follows the story of Henrietta S. Robertson. She's an English girl living in China during the 1930s and 1940s. And the reason that she's in China is her parents are missionaries there. And she is sent, like all of the other children in the missionary organisation, to a school, which is high atop this fabled mountain of Lushan, a mountain covered in mists and dangerous plunging ravines. And there she is sent, like the other children, because to allow the parents to pursue their calling. And while she's at the school, she believes that she's been given a divine calling of her own. And that calling takes her on a dangerous adventure, almost into the world of make-believe, and an adventure that the rest of her dorm go with her on. This is happening while the war is getting closer. The Japanese are venturing further inland in China, and there's dangerous echoes of war which drive the girls further into an imaginary world.
Absolutely. And Etta, as she is called.
Yes.
Etta is, she's an absolutely lovely little heroine. And to me, she reminded me of, like, the Salem witch trials, mm-hmm. of, she's in isolation. She's a creative, lonely, mm-hmm. lonely girl, mm-hmm. in a kind of harsh environment. Mm-hmm. Because not only are the parents of all of these kids missionaries, so filled with anything from enthusiasm and zeal to kind of crazy zealotry.
Yeah, yeah.
And the school is also run by a mixture of people of those of that persuasion, shall yeah. we say. And it is this hothoused environment. And to me, it was no surprise that, like, Jeanne d'Arc or, like, you know, other, I guess what we used to call hysterics, that, you know, that this pops into her head, you know, that in the void of anything warm, nurturing, motherly, that she creates her own voice and her own power.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really interesting way of looking at it. Yeah. Yeah. I suppose I wanted to create this sense of an intense world. It is very isolated. They're high up on this mountain peak. And you have, the children are very far away from their parents. They're being given good, in inverted commas, schooling. But what they don't have is attention and love. And they're very much expected, when they have sad moments, to turn to God or Jesus for comfort, not to feel a touch, or a kindly hand or a hug, something like that. So they're very far away from their family environment. And I was really interested on the impact of, yes, of that isolation that you talk about, and imagination, and how they can work with each other, and how the constructs of a religious faith can be interpreted in different ways. And I think Etta misinterprets, or she has her own interpretation, this mix of religion and imagination, and giving herself a unique role within her dormitory, and giving herself a sense of power and agency, perhaps to affect the world around her, where she maybe does feel very powerless.
Yes, and a sense of differentiating herself,
yeah.
and feeling special. And the thing that amused me highly, and it's just not something I've thought about. I don't come from a religious background. I do not come from a homogeneously religious culture either. So there's not that has not been my experience. So one of the funny things that comes out of that, which is any childhood, is where they get their information and what they do with it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because I can think back of, you know, the information we had about sex was from our equally idiotic and uninformed peers, or perhaps an older sibling of our equally idiotic and uninformed peers. And they do the same thing, but with like religious, you know, because those are the only contexts that they have.
That's right, yeah.
You know, like, you know, if you go down that mountain, God's going to get you. You know, like these crazy suppositions that they have, because they only have their teachers and the Bible to go by.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is very funny. There is one character that does have a softer spot for the girls. Muriel.
Yes, yeah.
And part of the story is told from her perspective. What role did she play for you?
I suppose I wanted to present someone who had questions, who was in a hothouse environment and taking part in it, but who also had the ability to have her own thoughts and questioning. I wanted to have a character who could provide an outside perspective on Etta, because it's mostly written from her point of view. So writing from the point of view of a child, there are a lot of things you can't quite include. You can't see them from the outside because you're writing this internal voice. So the character of Auntie Muriel allowed me to give a point of view on Etta that was outside the main narrative of the book. So that was very helpful, and also it allowed me to explore an adult's experience of being in this rather strange place on this mountain, and to look at faith, her received kind of Christian faith, and then what she's experiencing from the mountain, and this sense of otherness and a spirituality that perhaps exists beyond the confines of that very strict Christianity that she's part of.
RadioGorgeous.com.
So I don't want to give too much away of the sort of disastrous consequences of what occur when Etta takes it upon herself to embrace what she sees as her religious calling in being a prophetess.
Yeah.
But I do want to go into, it becomes a very different story once the Japanese occupation comes to the mountain.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden this, in some sense, pressurized and hothoused experience, but also we realize quite idyllic and removed from the pressures of daily life. It is like a monastery. It is this, they are atop a mountain.
Yeah.
A magical mountain.
Yeah.
And descending through the mists changes them all.
Hmm.
Talk to me a bit about, because I do know somewhat of the Japanese occupation of China and the resources that people end up having are very different than what they needed on the mountain.
That's it. I felt it would be really interesting to puncture this world that was created on the mountain. And the Japanese invading was really a way of doing that. I think you discover different parts of yourself when you're presented with different difficulties. And sometimes difficult situations can come into your life and you discover great resources that you never knew you had. Although they seem like really terrible experiences at the time, they can draw something out in you and help you build a new sense of who you are. In a way, looking at the book, I see it as Etta's pilgrimage, almost. That she, yes, as you said, these disastrous things happen because of her belief that she might be a prophetess. And in a way, going into the camp, which is a dark moment as well, she finds her own sense of self beyond this kind of religious construct. So that was a real, that was, I guess, the journey that I wanted to take the character on. And on the mountain at the school, she's surrounded by lots of quite fastidious Christian people. And here in the camp, she gets to meet all sorts of people with all sorts of colours and walks of life, and in them, in the most unlikely characters, finds a sense of goodness and of love and care that perhaps she's been missing and desiring. But people who aren't within a kind of on the religious spectrum, if you like. So, yeah, it felt I really wanted her to interact with a great range of people.
Because it is, in one hand, like you say, a sort of timeless coming-of-age story.
Yeah.
But it's set in exotic and dramatic backdrop.
Yeah.
Which you create seamlessly and in great detail. Where does that come from?
I guess I grew up in Southeast Asia, so in Thailand, and my parents were missionaries. So that really gave me a real desire to explore the life of a missionary kid. What was it like being a missionary kid, but in a different era and also in a different location from me? I think my imagination is excited, not necessarily by remembering my past directly, but by going and exploring something new, something that exists outside of my immediate experience, which is why I chose China and why I chose to set it during the Second World War, because I felt this was a very turbulent time, a time in a way the end of empire. Empire was really crumbling away by then, perhaps even the end of a religious faith for a whole nation that we know and understand, say, Britain as a Christian country, the beginning of the eroding of that. So it felt like a very exciting time. And I spent time in libraries, reading, looking through lots of photographs, and that helped me create this fictional world.
Radio Gorgeous, online, on your phone, on a podcast, or on your tablet. Listen anywhere, anytime.
It's not a story with black and white. There's grey, like in life. And one of the things that Etta sort of gradually sees is that people are not either good nor bad.
Yeah.
That situations have a lot of drivers.
Yeah. I think when you're a kid, sometimes you can adopt quite a black and white faith, or if you're in one of those religious communities anyway. And yes, I wanted to kind of crack that open and see her eyes kind of widen and be able to see people with a bit more humanity and less judgment. And I think often in quite a lot of religious culture is based on a lot of judgment and sense of black and white, what's right and wrong. But yeah, to open up to a bigger humanity, yeah.
I want to pick up on something you said right then, because it is outside of my experience.
Yeah.
And yet it is, you know, like a moment of the Crusades or of, religious wars in Europe.
Yeah.
How do you view, I mean, I don't know what is your spirituality like now? Is it different? Has it evolved? And how do you view how to navigate and negotiate that in, say, modern day London?
Mm. Wow, yes, that's a big and good question. Yeah, I suppose one of the exciting things about any relationship in a way is that it's dynamic and alive and always changing. And I suppose that's an image for a relationship with faith, that it does change over time. I think mine's gone through lots of different colours, and I think, again, we're talking about this binary, good or bad. I think certainly I find myself in a space where saying faith or not faith seems like quite a black and white question, but in this, I suppose I believe there's a great mystery and beauty to life, and I want to be able to appreciate that as much as possible. And I suppose my faith before was more about trying to understand things and label them and say why this happened, why that didn't happen, that is good, that is bad, whereas now I'm more in a place where I'm in a mystery and I'm okay with not knowing, if that's a roundabout answer to your question. Yeah. But how do you do that in modern day life? It is difficult. We live in such a sort of sped up, image saturated world, and how do people of any, whether your faith or not faith, create time and space to listen to your own voice? That's a real challenge for all of us. I think very important for everyone to be able to create that time for themselves to hear your own wisdom and your own inner voice, whether you call that God or yourself or the universe, I don't know, but that's certainly a challenge to how to be present each day and to be open. And
and that's a challenge regardless of whether you're in a strict, you know, religious group. That can still be a challenge.
Yeah.
Whether you're, you know, floundering and a banker and it's all meaningless, you know, it's the same challenge.
Yeah.
And I think it's the same job of each of us.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, if there is a purpose for us, it's to, you know, to make room to answer, to ask, to both ask and answer, or keep open those questions in ourselves.
Yeah, that's it. And I think, yes, things are so busy and cluttered today. How do we make room and make space and take that time? I think that's very important. And the voice of the world is so loud outside, from advertising to lots of music on our iPhones or taking pictures, Instagram, social media, to-do lists that we have to do. There's so much sound out there, and how can we listen to something, the quieter voice that goes underneath that? I think it's really important to be able to tap into that, because I think we are all have the divine in us, mm-hmm. and something of great value. And yeah, our job, yes, as you say, each person to listen to that and to be asking questions.
Yeah, because part of that noise that we hear constantly, vote, decide, buy, feedback.
Yeah.
That's all binary choices outside of yourself and telling you to judge, decide.
Yeah.
Make binary black and white choices.
Yeah.
Make, you know, good, bad.
Yeah.
Like, dislike.
And this sense of instant gratification. We expect so much now, which is great if you're using... great to be able to sort of shop online and get it the next day. I love all of those things. But we do live in that an era of instant gratification, of everything happening now. And I think the journey of the spirit doesn't go at that pace.
Radio Gorgeous.
I want to ask you about some of your own explorations more specifically, because I understand you've studied Japanese sword.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I got into the Japanese sword when I was in my early 20s. I really enjoy performing, and a friend of mine has a dance theatre company, and he recommended it as a great form of training for the body, and also you're training your mind as well. So I studied two different forms. One is Batado, where you work with a live blade, and another one is called Kendo. So that's the training the samurai would have done, where you wear armour and you have a wooden bamboo sword. And I found that a very, very helpful training, both for the body but also for the mind, just to have a real sense of being able to... I think the first thing I'd say that's really taught me is to be able to step into the unknown and into what I'm afraid. So I'm perhaps standing and facing my opponent. And I remember I was in Japan training, and it was the first time I'd worn all the armor. And the Japanese sensei, the teacher, asked everyone in the group to get up in a line and come and hit me on the head. And I remember feeling extreme pain on my head, being hit there. I was wearing armor, but still it was quite sore. And I began to shrink a little bit into myself. And he stopped everyone and said, to me, "Are you afraid?" And I said, "Yes, I am afraid." And he said, "Oh, you're being selfish." And I thought, what? And I realized, he said, "Yes, you must give everything to your opponent." So by standing there and cowering a little bit, or trying, really feeling the blows, was being in a way afraid. And actually, if I stood there and just gave my whole spirit to the opponent, I was that was a much better way of just facing them straight on. And then he got everyone to line up again, and I did that. I faced everyone with my whole spirit, and the pain stopped. I couldn't feel anything. It was a very strange experience. So I've really taken that lesson in life, and actually sometimes with writing, you can sit down to the page, and that's the person opposite you, your opponent, and do I just say, oh, I give it all, and don't be selfish by not facing openly an experience. You're actually being selfish. You're robbing yourself of the fullness of that experience, and you're robbing the other person, your opponent, of the fullness of the experience as well. So that's been extremely, extremely helpful to me.
I may be going out on a limb here, but it seems with all of that, it sounds to me like your sense of self is your home, mm-hmm. and you've moved so much,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know what the idea of home is for you, mm. because you have had such a peripatetic existence, mm. but that all of that, that is home,
yeah.
and you bring that wherever you go.
Yeah. Oh, that's really beautifully said. Yeah, I think that's exactly it. I think when you've had a childhood living in lots of different continents, then the thing that you carry with yourself and your suitcase is yourself. And this body is home. I think that's absolutely right. And how, yes, it's wonderful to have the opportunity to train that through martial arts or yoga, and to listen, yeah, to the ideas of the imagination that come from the connecting with the body as well. Yeah, I think you, yes, have to create your home within yourself. That's absolutely it. And the resources and the sense. Yeah, and what are your internal landscapes? That's right. My sister works with refugee children. So she's a dancer and choreographer, but she now works with them and trafficked children, helping them with their sense of home and how to create that in their body. So she works with them and movement to create that sense of home within the self, within the body. So I think it is a really important thing for us, those of us who've moved around quite a bit. Yes.
Edited by Ella Gray Thomas. This is a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com.